Hello and welcome to a new podcast series from Swansea University. My name's Sam Webster. You might recognise me from the Anatomy and Embryology podcast, and I have with me
Dr. Phil Newton.
Oh, Dr. Phil Newton today.
Well, you know, I throw my qualifications around a bit.
How are you, Dr. Phil?
I'm a bit tired, but otherwise well.
Phil has a new baby and chickens.
Mm-hmm. And they both keep me awake.
Yes. And of course, this is a very demanding job, which is very tiring.
Yes.
Yes. So you might know me as the Anatomy and Embryology lecturer here, and I've recorded a few podcasts in the past. Phil is keen to teach you lot neuroscience through the medium of podcast. And Phil is our new boy, our new neuroscience lecturer. Aren't you, Phil?
I am indeed.
Yes. So what we're planning to do is similar to what we've done with the Embryology podcast series, in that we're going to record probably a series of podcasts helping our students in Swansea by kind of re-recording the lecture, but suited for the podcast format. There's little differences, aren't there?
Yes. Yeah. We'll make it a little less formal and maybe explain some concepts that we haven't covered in detail in the lecture, but really just go over the key concepts in the lecture.
Yeah.
As a revision tool.
So the aim is that this podcast series will be the stuff that medical students need to know.
Yes.
Neuroscience students, yeah, there'll be useful stuff in here for them, but it'll probably maybe a little bit
Some of them will be useful eventually as we get a bit further down the line. Also, right. Psychiatry students as well. But neuroscience students should probably be familiar with the concepts we're going to talk about today. If they don't know what an action potential is, then they might want to rethink their honours degree.
Yeah. And it's going to have a clinical bent as well.
Yes.
Probably. So we're trying to keep med students interested, which it can't be easy to keep med students interested in neuroscience, can it?
Neuroscience is the most fascinating and most important discipline that any medical student will learn, Sam.
Of course it is. That's what I say about embryology. And they believe me after a couple of lectures as well.
Say that to me again?
They believe me after a couple of lectures as well.
They're just nodding, smiling politely, Sam.
Oh, is that what it is?
Because they think if they agree with you, then they'll get through it sooner.
And the ones at the back with their head in their hands, they're just sleeping or don't get it.
Yeah, or it was a heavy night.
Yeah, or they're listening to the podcast.
There you go. And it's put them to sleep.
Well, I have heard it has been used for that before.
You know, whatever it takes.
Okay, so Phil, what's your background? I said you're the new boy, so you're new to neuroscience teaching, but you've got a long history in neuroscience itself, right?
I have a background in neuroscience and neuropsychiatric research, mostly very basic science.
So you've been, as a researcher, you've been looking at the minutiae, the nitty-gritty, looking at this whole neuroscience thing from the inside out, from the cutting edge.
I have been pushing back the boundaries of scientific research in neuroscience, yes.
Sweet. And now you're...
And now I've decided I want to share basic neuroscience with the world.
Good. Yeah, and that's the aim of this podcast, is that it's for anybody who wants to listen to this sort of stuff, so it's available to anybody who wants it. I know we've had some good feedback in the past from medical students, so I guess that's going to be a similar audience, because those guys are struggling with exams.
No, they won't struggle with neuroscience. They'll be inspired.
This will be easy because they've listened to this series.
Yes.
Sweet. Excellent. So what sort of things are we going to cover in this podcast series?
In the podcast series,
we will
attempt to generate a podcast from every lecture, I think, and cover some of the, really revise the basic concepts, the key concepts that we covered in the lecture, maybe expand on things that students have come to me and said they have problems with, and summarize what's in the lecture for revision purposes.
Okay, and as I'm, my neuroscience knowledge is a tad weak. I know where the brain is roughly, and there's some stringy stuff coming out of it which connects to other parts of the body.
The less interesting part, yeah.
Yeah, I quite like those stringy bits.
Yeah, you also like cartilage, Sam.
I do, yeah. Articular cartilage is very interesting. Let's just talk about that for an hour, shall we?
We could probably talk about that for an hour if you talk.
But you'd probably sleep.
Cartilage... It's not my domain of expertise.
It will be when you get older.
When I don't have any.
Exactly.
Okay.
I forgot what I was going to say.
You were asking me what we were going to talk about. We're going to talk about...
Ah, yes. No, I was going to say that I'm going to, as my neuroscience isn't very good, I'm going to be asking the stupid questions that maybe students are a little bit afraid to ask. I'm going to try and pick up on the stuff that is a little bit tricky. Not that there's any such, there's no such thing as a stupid question, obviously. But if there were, I will ask it.
If anyone was going to ask a stupid question, Sam.
Thank you. So, yeah, Phil's going to teach me neuroscience as he teaches the world neuroscience.
Yes, I will pitch it at your level, Sam.
Oh,
I love you, really.
Okay, so today, what are we going to talk about?
Today, we're going to talk about basic, very basic fundamental concepts to all neuroscience. We're going to talk about what the neuron is, the basic building block of the nervous system, this major cell type in the nervous system. And we're going to talk about how neurons talk to each other, basically.
Okay.
And they are electrically excitable cells, and they talk to each other through the medium of electricity and chemistry. So we're going to talk about how they generate electrical signals and how those electrical signals are then propagated between neurons.
Sweet. Let's go.
All right. Well, I guess we will start with the resting membrane potential, which is the biophysical basis by which neurons store up the ability to generate an electrical signal. And all it basically is the idea that across the membrane of the neuron, there are differences in the concentration of certain key ions.
So between inside and outside the cell?
Yes, exactly. So we have differences in the concentration of sodium, potassium, calcium, chloride, and inorganic anions. And the differences in the concentration of those neurons generate an electrical potential across the membrane. So the outside of the cell, the outside of a neuron, is positively charged relative to the inside when the neuron is, as we say, at rest.
Uh-huh. So when it's kind of ready to go, when it's not even doing anything, it has a bunch of positively charged ions and negatively charged ions inside or outside to generate that difference in charge. Indeed. So I guess they have to be pumped in or out, otherwise they would kind of like settle down and equalize.
They do indeed. So the sodium-potassium exchanger is a key player in the generation and maintenance of the resting membrane potential. It chucks sodium out of the cell and it pumps potassium into the cell. Three sodium ions out for every two of potassium that come in, and it takes a lot of ATP, but it's absolutely essential for the electrical functioning of a neuron.
So you need to put energy in to pump these things around just to keep the cell at rest.
Yes.
Doesn't sound very restful.
Rest is perhaps a misleading term. It's primed and ready to go.
Ah.
And I guess the key thing to remember about the resting membrane potential is that you have two forces at work. Okay, you have the electrical charge that we talked about, with the outside being positive and the inside being negative, and then you have the chemical force of the concentration gradients of those different ions. And both of those are used by the neuron when it decides that it wants to, when it decides it no longer wants to be at rest and it wishes to fire an action potential.
Okay, so it's been told, triggered to fire an action potential?
Yes.
So what happens then?
Well, it's perhaps worth pausing a second to consider what it is that does the telling.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a question that many students asked me. I decided to start merely with the resting membrane potential and talk about action potentials in our lecture. And those students who are particularly keen obviously asked the question, where does the first action potential come from?
An inquiring bunch.
Well, they're a smart bunch, our medical students. Ask the difficult questions. Well, it's not a difficult question. It's very straightforward, and we will talk about it in week 129 when we talk about movement and how the stretching of a muscle, for example, generates an action potential. But the basic message is sensory information.
Right.
So when you look at something, or when you hear something, or when a muscle moves, various sensory receptors, which we will talk about eventually, initiate the firing of the first action potential in the chain. And that was the door. Okay, so I guess the simplest thing for us to do is to talk through the various phases of the action potential one by one. So an action potential is very simply what happens when a neuron decides to fire an electrical signal that will eventually result in it communicating with its neighbor neurons.
So we're talking about a really, really long cell.
In many cases, yes. People's traditional view of a neuron, which they may have got in, say, A-level biology, as of a very, very long cell traveling like all the way down the spine, or from one part of the brain to another. There are very short, spindly, stubby neurons in many parts of the brain.
But if we imagine we've got a really, really long cell,
yes.
So the action potential then is how that signal is going to down the length of that cell.
Exactly. So
being the descriptive term.
It's not a noise I can make. I don't think my mouth is shaped that way. I could say ping, perhaps.
Ping, okay.
I've lost me. All right.
Sorry.
Okay. So what we'll do is we'll talk about how the signal comes into the neuron to start with.
Yeah.
And how it is initiated, and then how it travels down the neuron, and then what happens when it gets to the end of the neuron and wishes to transfer across between neurons and start the whole process again on another neuron.
Okay.
So at the beginning, we have the binding of neurotransmitter released by, shall we say, our previous neuron onto our current neuron.
Okay.
And that neurotransmitter opens ligand-gated ion channels.
Ooh.
I know, it's fascinating and exciting stuff. So these ligand-gated channels will open and allow sodium to flood into the neuron. Okay? Now, our resting membrane potential, we talked about there being differences in the concentration of various ions.
Yeah.
There's a lot more sodium outside the cell than there is inside the cell.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a concentration gradient.
Yeah.
You open up a hole through which only sodium can travel, and thus sodium comes pouring into the cell down its concentration gradient.
So your neurotransmitter binds onto the ligand-gated
channel.
Uh-huh. Opens up the channel, whoosh, in it goes.
Whoosh, indeed. Sodium comes whooshing in. And the result of that sodium whooshing in down its chemical gradient is to affect the electrical potential across the membrane of the neuron.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that local change in membrane potential raises raises the resting membrane potential to what we call threshold.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you have a local depolarization caused by the opening of these ligand-gated ion channels. When that reaches a certain point, then we have voltage-gated ion channels that sense a change in membrane potential.
Yeah.
They then open and allow sodium to flood in. And then we have the beginnings of an action potential.
All right. And those, I guess, are staggered all the way down the length of the neuron.
Yes, indeed.
And it goes bum, 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 bum.
There is no change in the frequency or intensity of the bump. Is a key concept in the action potential. It does not change its intensity as it travels down the neuron. But we'll get to that later on. Don't worry.
But we get the idea.
Yes.
Okay.
It's something I didn't really mention in the lecture, and it's worth emphasizing. You can have a few receptors activated, a few ligand-gated channels open. That may not be enough to trigger an action potential. You have to reach this phenomenon that we call threshold.
Yeah.
Which, for those who are interested in the numbers, is approximately minus 40 millivolts.
Okay.
All right. So once we've reached threshold, our voltage-gated sodium channels open, and then things happen very, very quickly. Okay. Our sodium comes flooding into the cell very rapidly, and the resting membrane potential is effectively turned on its head. Okay. The chemical gradients get all messed up, obviously, because sodium comes flooding in. This messes up the electrical gradients, and the cell depolarizes.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And this happens in a local fashion. Okay, so it starts, it's a case of simplicity, it starts at the beginning of the neuron, and as we'll talk about in a few moments, then travels down the neuron. So the voltage-gated sodium channels open, and the cell neuron fully depolarizes. And once it reaches a certain level of depolarization and it's chocked full of sodium, then the sodium channels close.
Uh-huh.
And this is what we call the peak of the action potential.
Right.
And this is a very key point, key phase. Reaching this peak, filling up with tons of sodium, triggers the opening now of voltage-gated potassium channels.
Right.
Okay, so the rising phase... Initial phase, the reaching threshold, and the rising phase all involve sodium.
Yeah.
Once we get to the top of the action potential,
yeah,
we then initiate what we call the falling phase, and we open voltage-gated potassium channels.
Right.
Okay, which then allow potassium to flood back out of the cell.
Okay.
Okay, so you have two positively charged ions moving in opposite directions.
Yeah, I think I see where this is going.
And what happens is eventually we end up back down at our resting membrane potential.
Yeah.
Okay, so our chemical balance is all messed up, but our electrical balance is maintained, not maintained, it's restored by letting sodium go flooding out of the cell.
Potassium.
Potassium, yeah. They're all the same, aren't they? You know? Positively charged, small, you know. Set on fire, yeah, when you put them on water. That's
sure.
Okay, so our voltage-gated potassium channels are also triggered by the change in membrane potential. So their opening is triggered by the same thing that triggers the voltage-gated sodium channels. But they open with a 1 millisecond delay.
What does that mean? Why is that relevant?
That means you, rather than them having them opening at the same time and the chemical gradients cancelling each other out and there being no change in the electrical signal.
Yeah.
Because the potassium channels open with a 1 millisecond delay, you get this electrical signal generated.
That allows that peak.
Exactly.
To occur.
Exactly. And it allows the action potential to remain local, as it were. Okay. So you have this all happens in a very local fashion. And then if you imagine the action potential is occurring in a very small section of the neuron, that section then travels down the neuron.
Okay.
Okay. But as more sodium floods into a particular area, in one particular locality, it triggers the action potential. But that sodium diffuses out either side. And where it diffuses forward, it then triggers the opening of more voltage-gated sodium channels. So more sodium comes in, which diffuses out in front, which et cetera, et cetera. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. See how that works now.
You are looking enraptured, Sam.
I am. Well, this is more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Is it more interesting than articular cartilage?
No. It's more interesting than it was when I first did it 15 years ago.
Okay. Well, we'll work on it. Don't worry. And it's actually a concept I meant to mention at the very beginning. This is, if you think these concepts are in any way difficult, this is the most difficult neuroscience will be. As part of the medical course, at least.
I don't believe you.
Nothing we do from here will be more complex in a biophysical sense.
Okay.
All right.
Good. Yeah. Yeah, I look forward to that.
I know. So it's downhill from here. All right. So where were we? Falling phase. All right. So our sodium has done its thing, has gone tanking out of our cell. And what happens is our neuron overcompensates ever so slightly. You can think of it as it letting too much potassium out.
Right, yeah.
And so having gone from the threshold to the rising phase, to the peak, to the falling phase, we now enter a period called after hyperpolarization.
Uh-huh.
Okay, where the membrane potential dips below what it was at rest.
Right, okay.
And the only thing you really need to remember about this phase is the concept that because the resting membrane potential is dipped below what it was at rest, it is now harder to fire another action potential.
Ah.
Okay, and this is just the period where basically the neuron sorts itself out. Its sodium-potassium exchanger sorts out the...
It's got to start pumping the ions back around again to get back to that resting phase. There's a little bit of a delay then before you can use that neuron again.
Exactly.
Ah.
So it prevents... It allows the neuron to recover, prevents it from becoming chemically exhausted, and prevents wild and uncontrollable action potential firing.
So how big is that delay normally, roughly?
On a time scale, it's about a millisecond.
Right. It's huge.
Our neurons are pretty quick.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
The whole firing of an action potential from initiation back to the maintenance of the resting potential is about 3 milliseconds.
Wow.
With the peak occurring just before 1 millisecond.
Mm.
That's why you're so smart, Sam. Because your neurons act so quickly.
I'm glad they act quickly.
If only a bone grew. same later.
Yeah, I'm sat here with a broken foot. It's not repairing that quickly.
And he hasn't mentioned it at all until this point.
Yeah, I'd forgotten it was there. I was so interested in this, I forgot it was there.
I'm glad it's good for something. The analgesic effects of neuroscience lecturing.
Yes, I'm going to use it to sleep to later.
All right, so what we're talking about. All right, and an analogy that has been used, and I guess may be used again, is that the after hyperpolarization phase, or what we call also the refractory period, is a bit like when you flush the toilet. The cistern has to refill before you can flush it again.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Yeah, good.
Okay. Add some clinical relevance, some pharmacological relevance into these concepts to demonstrate to you that they're not just abstract science and they are actually important. Many local anesthetics and anticonvulsant drugs act by blocking voltage-gated sodium channels. And in so doing, they block the firing of action potentials. So things like lidocaine, which may be called lignocaine in the UK, I don't know, and carbamazepine, which is marketed as Tegretol, they block voltage-gated sodium channels. So action potentials don't fire, and your neurons are quiet and maintained at rest.
Clever.
If you eat sushi from a pufferfish, from fugu.
Oh, yes.
And you eat the wrong bit, or it's not been carved correctly, and you die, which is a very common side effect of eating fugu sushi, then you will have died because your voltage-gated sodium channels will be blocked with tetrodotoxin.
Wow.
So as you take your last breaths, you will at least know what is happening to you.
If you can remember that word.
Which word?
Tetrodotoxin.
You can at least be aware of the concept that your voltage-gated sodium channels are being blocked.
Yes, good. Okay, so that's what happened to Homer, or didn't happen to Homer Simpson.
I must have missed that episode.
Thought he was dying, but didn't die.
Apparently, the very best pufferfish sushi should make your lips tingle.
Oh, I don't like that idea.
Because you have just the right amount of tetrodotoxin to make your lips and tongue go a little bit numb.
Okay.
Well, you know, some people get excitement from sushi.
Mm.
It's other people's articular cartilage.
Yeah.
All right, so what can I tell you about action potentials? A couple of extra key features of the action potential that we should mention. I think we may have already mentioned the fact that they do not degrade as they travel down the axon. And they are also an all or nothing phenomenon, which I think we touched on briefly earlier. Once an action potential is triggered, it will fire, and that's that. You don't have a big action potential or a small action potential or whatever. No gradient.
Just is what it is and just goes and does its job.
A binary thing, yes or no. And something else important we should mention is that they travel faster down the axon when that axon is myelinated.
Yes.
So myelin is electrical insulation tape for neurons. That's really all you need to know about it. It's mostly lipid, 80% lipid, 20% protein. It's wrapped around the neuron in various different ways, depending upon the type of neuron.
Uh-huh.
And it insulates the electrical signal. And it's important because many disorders that we will cover in later weeks are associated with a disruption of that myelin. So multiple sclerosis, Guillain-Barre syndrome, things like that are demyelinating disorders. And they're not very good.
Sure.
All right. So that's how an action potential travels down a neuron. Do you think you understand everything, Sam?
Yes, I think I could pass a test on that now.
You do?
I do.
We may have to put that test to the test.
Yeah, no, that was good. That was, it's something I know about, but of course I haven't thought about it for many, many years, and some of it came back, and yeah, no, it's good.
Now you're enraptured.
Yes, looking forward to the next one.
Well, that's only action potentials. Now we're going to talk about what happens when the action potential gets to the end of the neuron.
We're going from one cell to another cell now.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
So the action potential is just the neuron finding its voice, and then when it wants to talk to the next neuron, it has to turn that electrical signal into a chemical signal.
Ah.
All right, your voltage-gated calcium channel. It is the mechanism via which electricity is turned into chemistry. So You want to ask me a question?
I was going to say, so we've talked about sodium and potassium so far, have we, those channels? Yes. And now we're talking about a calcium channel.
Yes.
So a third type of channel.
It's a third type of channel, and it's really the action potential itself only really involves sodium and potassium, actually, and then turning that into neurotransmitter release, which is what happens at the end of the action potential, involves calcium. And the inorganic anions we talked about earlier are only really important because they help maintain the resting membrane potential.
Yeah.
And the chloride ions, which we'll talk about perhaps in a few moments, are important for the actions of inhibitory neurotransmitters.
Yeah.
So everything we talked about so far, it's really what happens when an excitatory neurotransmitter activates a neuron and tells it to talk to the next neuron. All right, so the action potential travels down the neuron. Yep. It reaches what we call the axon terminal, which is the end of the neuron. And our voltage-gated calcium channels sense this change in membrane potential that occurs when the action potential arrives. Excuse me. And they open and let calcium come in. And I've told the students about this probably, I don't know, 15 times. So they're probably sick to death of it by now. Calcium comes in and initiates a whole series of biochemical events, which we don't need to worry about in great detail. And they cause the release of neurotransmitter from one neuron, which then travels across what we call the synaptic cleft.
Yep.
And binds to neurotransmitter receptors on the next neuron, and the whole process continues again.
And that's it. So the neurotransmitter binds and vroom, off it goes again.
If it is an excitatory neurotransmitter that is released.
Yeah.
And the appropriate neurotransmitter receptors are present on the postsynaptic neuron.
Ah.
Okay. So the gap over which the neurotransmitter travels is called the synaptic cleft. And that together with the terminals of the two neurons is called the synapse, or maybe the synapse. I can't remember which is British and which is American. I'm sorry.
Me neither, now you've said it. So why wouldn't a receiving neuron have receptors for that neurotransmitter?
It usually would, but the receptors come in a variety of different shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
So most neurotransmitters have many, many different forms of receptor. Serotonin has 17 different types of receptors.
Really?
And the effects of that serotonin are going to vary depending upon the receptors that are present on the postsynaptic neuron. And we will talk all about that in our neurotransmitters podcast.
See, you're thinking in the brain. I'm still thinking in ganglia. I'm still thinking outside the brain, see?
A bit primitive.
Like me, see?
We'll come on to them, I think, at some point. What else can I tell you? Yes. So we'll briefly talk about chloride.
Okay.
So our neurotransmitter is released. It binds to our neurotransmitter receptor. And in the example we talked about earlier, that is a ligand-gated sodium channel. It lets sodium flood in and starts the firing of another action potential.
Yeah.
If the neurotransmitter that is released is an inhibitory one, something like glycine or gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA,
yep.
Then the ligand-gated ion channel does not conduct sodium. It conducts chloride.
Right.
And chloride, there's already... chloride travels down a chemical gradient exactly the same way sodium does. Okay? There's tons of chloride outside the cell. There's not much inside the cell. Mm. So when you open a chloride channel, chloride comes into the cell.
Yeah.
But chloride is negatively charged.
Oh, okay.
The inside of the cell is already negatively charged.
Yeah.
So when you get more negative going in, it hyperpolarizes the neuron, which means that it is less likely to now fire in action potential.
So that's how that works.
See,
I look at the diagrams. I never thought how it works.
You don't have to worry about diagrams. I should show you some of my fascinating animations if you have time, Sam.
Yeah.
I know that the students particularly appreciate them.
Good.
Yeah.
They laugh at mine.
They'd laugh at mine too.
Oh, okay.
When I show them for the 25th time. I don't think it's a particularly amused laugh. It's more of a sort of sympathetic. It's the sad little man with a sad little picture.
Yeah, that's what I get, yeah.
Oh, well, at least we're the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's pretty much how it works. That's pretty much all you need to know about action potentials and resting membrane potential and neurotransmitter release.
Good, top stuff. So now we know how it all works. What is it we're going to talk about next, you know? As in the next podcast or the next lecture?
The next lecture that the students will have received will have been a little bit of an aside about the neurobiology of appetite regulation, which we will talk about eventually before the exams to generate some revision material. But in terms of this theme, the next thing we'll talk about is neurotransmitters.
Okay.
We'll talk about all the different neurotransmitter types, their different types of receptor, what the different functions are, what some drugs are that block them, activate them, etc., etc.
Okay, sounds good.
Add some detail.
Yeah, add some detail and then, yeah, see how it all hooks up.
Yeah. Piece of cake.
Good stuff. Yeah, no, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm still with it.
You are? You sure?
Yeah, I think so.
Does your foot still hurt?
I'll keep it up. No, I forgot it was there.
So I did suggest that the students fill in the scaffold, as it were, look at a few other different concepts related to this that we won't cover in detail in lectures. Neurons come in all different shapes and sizes. We touched upon that. Your archetypal one is a long, skinny one. There are ones that look like Christmas trees, ones that look like flowers.
Yeah.
All different shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
Just be aware of that.
Yeah, it's helpful to know that they are all a little bit different.
Yes.
Yeah.
And obviously we've talked about one neuron releasing a neurotransmitter that then acts upon one other neuron.
Yeah.
It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Most neurons talk to hundreds, thousands of other neurons.
Really?
But we don't need to worry about that again in great detail.
Don't fancy seeing that diagram.
It's the sort of diagram you look at and think, yeah, it's complicated. I don't think I'll consider it further.
Okay.
And that's really it, I think.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, so when are we going to punch these out? Kind of one for each lecture-ish, once every now and then again, once a month?
I think we'll try and make one for each lecture, and then maybe if there are concepts or subjects that lots of people have the same question about, then we might generate another podcast to address those questions.
Yeah, if you have any specific questions, you can send us a request to s.v.webster@swansea.ac.uk and maybe we'll talk about it.
Okay. Yeah. I have a request for that email address. I'd like to send you £1 million. I'm a Nigerian bank.
Yeah, thanks.
Anytime.
I've had a few of those. Well, thank you, Phil. I think that was good.
It was a pleasure.
All right, we'll do this again next time.
Okay, see you later.
Ta-da.